This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Fire in the hole!
That's my guest Walton Goggins playing a white supremacist shouting fire in the hole as he blows up a black church with a rocket launcher. It's a scene from the first episode of the FX series Justified, which was based on an Elmore Leonard story. Episode 11 was shown last night. In the interim, Goggins' character, Boyd Crowder, did time in prison where he was born again and dedicated himself to Jesus. Or so he says. I first became aware of Walton Goggins through his terrific performances in the FX series The Shield as Detective Shane Vendrell, a member of a corrupt narcotics strike team. Here's another clip from Justified. A deputy U.S. Marshal, Raylan Givens, played by Timothy Oliphant, has been sent back to his hometown in Kentucky, where his old friend Boyd Crowther, played by Goggins, is being investigated for robbing a bank. Boyd and Raylan used to work together in the coal mines when they were teenagers. Now they're on opposite sides of the law. In this scene, before Boyd's alleged conversion, Boyd and Raylan are meeting again after many years and have been talking about the time they spent together in the mines. Boyd, the white supremacist, speaks first.
Yeah, all those days, good and bad, they all long gone now. Everything's changed.
It's all changed.
Mine has changed. No more falling the seam underground. Cheaper to take the tops off mountains and let the slag run down and ruin the creeks. Hey, you remember the picket lines, don't you? Of course, back into company scabs and gun thugs.
Whose side do you think the government's always been on, Raylan? Us or people with money?
And who do you think controls that money? Who do you think wants to mongrelize the world?
Who?
The Jews.
What? You know any Jews?
See, I recruit skins. They don't know no more than you do. And I have to teach them that we have a moral obligation to get rid of the Jews. See, it was in the Bible.
Where?
In the beginning. It's part of creation. See, in the beginning, right, you had your mud people. Now, they were also referred to as beasts because they had no souls. See, they were soulless. And then Cain, you remember Cain now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Cain, he laid down with the mud people. And out of these fornications came the Edomites. Now, do you know who the Edomites are?
Who?
They're the Jews, Raylan.
You're serious?
Read your Bible as interpreted by experts.
Oh, you know, Boyd, I think you just use the Bible to do whatever the hell you like.
Well, what do you think I like, Raylan?
You like to get money and blow shit up.
That's a scene from the FX series Justified. Walton Goggins, welcome to Fresh Air. You may be a white supremacist in Justified, but I love watching you. It is so much fun to watch you in this series. Did you feel like you had to figure out why some people become white supremacists before you could play one?
On some level, but I never believed that Boyd Crowder was a white supremacist, to be quite honest with you. In my conversations with both the network and with Graham Yost, our executive producer, and Tim Oliphant, it was very important for me as an actor not to play this guy as a white supremacist, but to play him as a bit of a Svengali. A person who doesn't necessarily believe all that he espouses. So to that extent, yeah, I needed to understand how one might go about recruiting people and a diatribe or a monologue that might service that end. But beyond that, I don't believe his heart, Boyd Crowder's a racist person. No, I don't.
Is that because you couldn't believe that you had it in you to play that? Is that self-protection,
no, you
in
know,
other words?
I think, you know, I've made 4 Southern movies. I've been in quite a few Southern films. And initially, when this was sent to me, I wasn't interested in playing another Southern guy labeled as a racist. You know, I think racism is a problem throughout our country, and it's not confined to those states below the Mason-Dixon line. And for me, I did not want to perpetuate a stereotype. So I had them take out references to our president, Barack Obama, and I wouldn't say the N-word, and I said I would do this if Raylan was able to point out that Boyd doesn't necessarily believe that which he is saying, and that was very important to me. The other thing that I wanted to explore with Boyd, which I think is more appropriate for him as a person, kind of getting in his skin, was to explore his intellect. And I don't think that that was there in the original pilot. It was tweaked very easily, with a couple of different sentences here and there that explored how smart this guy really was. That was important to me, more so than that was interesting to me. Just to be a racist didn't interest me.
So going along with the premise that your character is a really smart man who is in a bad situation and has become a white supremacist, not because he deeply believes that everything is the Jews' fault and black people's fault, but because that's the way to get power in the area that he is with the people that he knows. He goes to prison, and in prison he undergoes a religious conversion and is born again and dedicates his life to Jesus, so he says. So I want to play a scene after that conversion, and this is a scene in which Raylan, the U.S. Marshal, played by Timothy Oliphant, is visiting him, you, in jail. And Raylan had shot you in a previous episode. He knows that you blew up an African-American church and that you shot your associate right after. And also, you had told him that if he didn't leave town, you'd kill him. So he shot you right after you were drawing on him. He intentionally didn't shoot you in the heart. You survived. And now, as we'll hear, you're preaching to him that he needs to mend his ways. So here's Timothy Oliphant visiting you in prison.
Why, hello there, Raylan.
Hello, Boyd. How you doing?
Food isn't as advertised, and there was no mint on my pillow, so I don't think that I would come back to this particular hotel. But it is better than Alderson. Or maybe I'm better. See, I've done a lot of bad things in my life, but what I know now is that the only hope I have of saving my own soul is by helping to save the soul of others. But I can see by the glazing of your eyes that you didn't ask to see me because you wanted to hear about my ministry. How can I help you, Raylan?
I saw Arlo the other day.
Well, how did that go?
I want to know everything you know about what he's up to.
Well, if I tell you, what do I get?
What do you want?
Well, you understand what it is that you're asking for. I mean, me asking people in here about your daddy, I mean, that could put me in a very compromising position.
You want me to arrange for that man on your pillow?
No, Raylan. The only thing that I want you to do is to think about your immortal soul. You are a violent man, my friend. You have left a trail of dead behind you. You think about it, the life that you've led, the work that you've done. At one moment, you could be breaking into the home of a fugitive. And the very next moment, you could be facing your final judgment. Now, how do you think that you're going to fare on that glorious, glorious day, Raylan Gibbons?
It's always a good question.
Well, it's the most important question there is.
It's a scene with Timothy Oliphant and my guest Walton Goggins from the FX series Justified. I have no idea watching the series whether you're serious about Jesus and having been converted or not, and I'm wondering if you know.
I do know. I think it was a discovery, you know, along the way. I don't think I knew initially. I don't think that Graham or the other writers on the show knew initially, and I thought it best that we, as did they, that we keep it ambiguous until we figure it out. I think that I figured it out shortly thereafter.
He's organizing a church now made up of meth dealers and survivalists. Yeah, and
absolutely. Black and white, by the way. Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
That's part of his revelation.
He's a walking paradox for sure.
So you grew up in the South. You were born in Birmingham and grew up in Georgia. The accent that you use in the show, is that an accent that you're familiar with? Because it's supposed to be a Kentucky accent.
It is supposed to be a Kentucky accent. I don't know quite how accurate it is. I did study a little bit about people from Kentucky and kind of how they talk. It's not an accent that I'm familiar with. It's different because the cadence is so specific to Elmore Leonard, and it's slightly stilted and heightened in a way that I also think reflects for me what I'm trying to do, whether it comes across or not, but something that speaks to Boyd's intelligence. You know, more often than not, I don't or haven't seen Southern characters like this with a penchant and a love for words. And we were able to, in the pilot episode, kind of introduce that. And he says, innocuous. I was sitting there right before we were going on and talking over the scene with Graham and said, you know, what if he were to say, just kind of offhandedly, because it's the way his mind works, he were to say, you picked an innocuous target. You know what that means? That means harmless. So he not only uses these words, but he also gives the definition right afterwards, as if he's very proud of knowing how to use a certain word.
And that he also assumes the people who he knows won't know the word.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the people that he hangs out with won't know the answer to the definition of those words.
So the first episode of Justified is based on an Elmore Leonard short story called Fire in the Hole.
It is.
And I'll confess, I haven't read that story. So I was wondering, does your character in that story have the religious conversion, or does that story end before the arc?
That story ends with the death of Boyd Crowder. And I have not read that short story either, and purposefully did not read it after getting the job because I didn't want to be influenced by it. Mm-hmm. But as I understand it, he dies at the end of the pilot, which is exactly how we filmed it. I was only to do one episode. Boyd Crowder actually does get shot in the heart. It is only after showing it to audiences that Boyd Crowder lived. About 3 months later, right when the show was getting picked up, I came on to do more episodes, and we reshot the ending so that Boyd had an opportunity to live.
Oh, resurrected.
Yeah, absolutely. He's like Jesus. He is Jesus. He came back in 3 months.
Can you, like, deconstruct the voice that you do a little bit for us? Like, give an illustration of how you put it together?
Well, this is a person with probably a ninth grade education. I think he's extremely well-read. I don't think that he feels the need to raise his voice in certain ways. I think he understands the power of manipulation sometimes can lie in whispering to people and getting close to people and not averting one's gaze, but looking deep into their eyes and talking to their very soul.
Right, good.
How did that come off?
Very well.
Good. So do I have you on my team, Terry?
I don't think
do
so.
Do I have you?
No. Not on Boyd's team. No, thank
yes,
you.
Yes, I understand.
So what was it like to like have a swastika tattoo and, you know, spout all that Christian identity, religion stuff? I mean, that there's the Christian identity movement that believes Jews are the mud people.
Yeah, it was, you know, honestly, it was awful. It really was. A lot of my friends at FX are, one gentleman in particular, Eric Schreier, is Jewish, and we did a table reading of this script. And I had to say that monologue, and immediately after felt like I had to say, I'm sorry, I don't believe any of this. Everyone in the room, I have, my best friends are Jewish. It's difficult, and it's difficult to have a swastika on your arm, you know. And I actually wore it home. I didn't let him take it off, so I kept it with me during the process of filming the pilot episode. And there were
wait, you wanted to
times,
be infected by it?
Yeah, I think so. I think you know you're certainly infected or affected by ink on your body in something as powerful, a symbol as powerful as a swastika. I definitely wanted to kind of feel that. And there were times during the day when I wasn't working and I was out at dinner that I would roll up my T-shirt and I would leave the swastika there just to see people's reaction. And there was one time when I was with Tim and I had rolled my shirt up just to see what would happen. And Tim didn't notice it for about 5 minutes until there were tourists walking through the lobby of the hotel who almost gasped. You could hear them step back with their Starbucks coffee in their hand. And Tim said, please, please roll down your shirt, please, or I'm going to have to leave you here alone.
Well, yeah, I can understand his sentiment. I mean, like sporting a swastika in public is a very vile act. It's a very provocative act.
It is.
I mean, what kind of reaction were you expecting?
I knew that I would get that reaction. I just wanted to see. I just wanted to see what that would be like.
It's funny, nobody noticed that you're both like actors, that you're both stars.
not for a minute, but I definitely explained afterwards that it was fake. It wasn't real. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Walton Goggins, and he was one of the stars of The Shield, and he's now one of the stars of the new FX series Justified. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Walton Goggins. He's now starring as a white supremacist turned born-again Christian in the new FX series, Justified. And he also played Shane in the FX series, The Shield. Let me ask you about The Shield and your character on it, Shane Vendrell. And you were one of the members of this really corrupt strike team. It was a narcotics team that worked the streets of L.A. and was supposed to be busting, you know, drug gangs. But it was they were pretty dirty, so that they always took drugs and money. And
to say that they were immoral would not be an understatement. Yes.
Yes. And your character, Shane, he often thinks he's smart and that he can really come up with these schemes and even be smarter than Vic, who's the leader of the team, but he's sometimes just like really stupid and impulsive and does the wrong thing. And I thought we could play a scene here. And season one ends with all the members of this small strike team standing around like a dumpster of money that they've managed to steal from an Armenian gang that trafficked in prostitutes and drugs and other things. So they're standing around this like dumpster of money, and they have to figure out where are they going to put it? What are they going to do with it? And then when the next season picks up, this is a scene in which Michael Chiklis, as Vic, the leader of the strike team, is coming to see you because he needs some of the money. Here's the scene.
Hey, what's up?
I need to make an emergency withdrawal from the retirement fund. You got your key, right?
Vic, there's nothing in there.
You gotta be joking me.
No, we took it. Me, Lim, and Ronnie, we took it to invest.
Without telling me?
You put me in charge while you were taking time off.
A quarter of that stash is mine.
And I'm in the process of tripling it for you. It was gonna be a surprise.
It is. A bad one.
Like, I've been giving this thing a lot of thought.
Yeah? And what's your plan, exactly?
I've been stepping up shipments. I've been overseeing distribution.
Distribution? We're middlemen keeping the peace, not drug dealers. What the hell are you doing?
I'm not doing anything that we weren't doing before. I'm just bumping things up a level.
Well, what level is that? Prison? All right, where's my investment now?
It's all tied up in the coke shipment.
That coke that had Tio's guy bleeding from every orifice?
We don't know that that was the coke.
I need that money.
Yeah? Well, we all do.
No, I need it now to get back my kids.
That's a scene from the FX series The Shield, which is, of course, on DVD. And Walton Goggins, who played Shane, is my guest. I want you to talk about how you see the character of Shane and how you developed him.
I think that you're exactly right in the sense that he's... you know, he arrives in the room 30 seconds too late and is continually playing catch up. And he's not a very smart guy and doesn't think before he acts, but a great foot soldier and extremely, extremely loyal to Vic. And I don't think that Vic could have been the person that he became without a sidekick like Shane. But when Shane stepped out and tried to do the same thing, he failed miserably. Whenever he takes a leadership position, he fails miserably. He's a tragic, tragic guy.
I love watching your face in the shield because sometimes you're just kind of blank and clueless looking, and sometimes incredibly defensive, and sometimes really hurt. There's all these like expressions that flash across your face, your eyes.
He's just mentally processing. It's like he's just trying to understand what the person just said. He spends a lot of time just playing catch up.
My guest Walton Goggins will be back in the second half of the show. He's in the FX series Justified, which is shown Tuesday nights, and he co-starred in the FX series The Shield. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor Walton Goggins. He's in the new FX series Justified, where he plays a white supremacist who has maybe converted to born-again Christianity. We're not really sure. When we left off, we were talking about his role on an earlier FX series, The Shield, in which he played Detective Shane Vendrell, a member of a corrupt narcotics team. I consider The Shield to be like your work in The Shield to be your breakout role. How did you get the part?
Well, I, you know, like most other actors in this town, you get sent a pilot, a screenplay or a teleplay rather, and you think that this is the one. This could change my life, maybe, maybe not. And I had gotten sent this script and read it, and was blown away by it. I'd never read anything like it. And had been in a couple of pilots that had failed before, and had finally come to the conclusion that for someone like me to really succeed in television, it would have to be something that was a little off the grid and something further afield. And I read it and thought, this is it. If I can just get this job, if I can improvise this scene that they've written, because there are only four lines that Shane has in the pilot. If I can do it, I know I can make them see something. And, you know, went in and met with Sean Ryan and our late executive
the creator
producer, Scott,
of the series,
creator
yeah.
of The Shield, absolutely. And our late executive producer, Scott Brazil, and our directors, Clark Johnson. And we just talked about it, and I told them my thoughts on it, and I thought that this was a very pessimistic guy. He's a very cynical guy. And I also thought he was a really funny guy. I thought that his sense of humor came through his cynicism, and that was something to be explored. And I also knew, just in the writing of the pilot, and was assured by Sean that going forward, Shane would play a significant role, a very significant role in the series. But I was assured on the page by the fact that Shane was involved in the original sin of the show, which was killing another police officer. And these two men, Shane Vendrell and Vic Mackey, were inexorably tied to this original sin. So I knew that it would come home to roost eventually. I didn't know exactly how it would play out, or that it would begin unraveling as soon in the series. It was interesting, after the pilot episode, and I didn't find this out till the end of the season when we were doing some DVD commentary, Sean Ryan said, you know, after the executives at the network saw the pilot, they wanted to fire you. And I said, really? They said, yeah, they found you abrasive, and they didn't think that the audience would like you very much, or could get to like you very much. I said, I had four lines. Can I offend people? Really? With four lines? Wow, then have I accomplished that? And Sean said, I knew that I needed to convince them to have you stay.
So in the final season, Shane is really over his head. He's betrayed the cops that he works with. Vic wants to kill him. And so do the Armenians who Shane stole money from. He's hiding out with his wife. She's hurt herself. She's hurt her collarbone in a fight, I think, with drug dealers. And I want to play a scene from that part of the series. So you're both hiding out. You're just coming back to the place where you've been hiding out. And she's lying down in great pain from her injury.
Hey. I'm sorry it took so long. How is it?
It's awful.
I couldn't get us anything to eat because the cops, they spotted me. Yeah, I had to ditch the car.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. Don't worry about me. You just, I want you to take these.
What are they?
They're second oils. And they will help with the pain. Okay.
Oh. What else do you care?
Just some street, you know, some meth and weed, but a little blow. But I had to do most of it. The stuff that they made me do last night, I was cratering. And I need to stay focused. So that I can get us out of this.
You can't help us if you're high, baby.
It was just enough to even me out. Okay, I promise.
That's a scene with my guest Walton Goggins from The Shield. Now, I read that when you were young, you were good at competitive hog calling, and I'm not even sure what that is, having grown up in Brooklyn.
You guys didn't hog haul in Brooklyn?
No.
That's not how you got your pork in Brooklyn?
We got our pork in Chinese restaurants.
I understand. I understand. You know, I was first place state champion hog hauler. I'll do a little. I'll do just a... Sweet. I think that's about as loud as I can get in the studio. But as I was 10 years old and saw other people doing it, and walked up on stage, and they had to adjust the mic for sure, and just leaned up on my tiptoes, and I won. I got a trophy with a big hog on top. I have it in my office.
So when you win the competitive hog calling championship, is it just like, do hogs it's have to actually respond and say, yes, but coming?
Hogs don't have to respond, Terry. Hogs don't have to respond. It's the audience that responds. The audience is sitting there responding to the hog call. And right when you're done with the hog call, they usher you off to the grease pig contest.
Which is what?
They put $20 bill on the back of a hog and they grease it up. And the person who gets the $20 bill gets the $20 bill.
Oh, wow. So was your hog calling like step one toward acting? You know, you're at a mic, it's a performance, you're doing voices.
Yeah, absolutely. I go back to it as much as I can. I grew up in around a bunch of women, believe it or not. And my aunt was an actress in the theater and another aunt who was a publicist for B.B. King and Phyllis Diller and Wolfman Jack. So
really?
I got to meet some of them through her, but I also grew up watching my aunt perform on stage. And I think that's where I got the initial bug. But early on, when I first began in Georgia, it was also an opportunity just to kind of exercise some of these emotions, you know, that I was having an angst-ridden teenager, and it felt good. It really felt therapeutic.
You know,
I didn't know that I would be doing this for the rest of my life.
It's funny you said angst-ridden teenager, because Shane on The Shield, your character in The Shield, sometimes behaves like an angst-ridden teenager with Vic as his father. You know, it's like his way of obeying or disobeying. It's kind of like what a uncomfortable teenager would do, who's not yet confident in the world, but you know. Wants to follow, but also doesn't want to go along sometimes.
Absolutely. You know, I think that that Shane, I think that's a part that kind of comes from me. He didn't have the strongest father figure in his life, in Shane's life. He didn't have a male significant figure in his life and really looked up to Vic. Vic took that that spot for Shane, and in no small way defined his moral code. I don't know that Shane would have gone down that path left to his own vices. I think it was under the tutelage of Vic Mackey that Shane went down that road.
Did you travel with cops, understudy cops, before doing the role? And I don't think any cops would much want to be associated with the characters that you and the other leads played, because you were just so corrupt and amoral.
I did. I spent, I'd gone on a number of ride-alongs with police officers here in Los Angeles, and then spent time in my car before every season. Would drive around this city and the places that we were supposed that kind of represented Farmington in the story. And, you know, Chiklis said something early on, and I found this to be very true. You know, The Shield is fiction. I mean, it is entertainment. We tried to make it as real as possible, but it is fiction. And Chiklis said, anyone below the rank of captain will tell you that they love the show. They absolutely love the show. Anyone above the rank of captain will publicly say that they hate the show, but privately tell you that they love it. And I found that to be the case, you know, over the years with the numbers of cops that I had met over the years, and it was there were some strange interactions with the cops.
Well, tell us
over
about
the
one
years.
Of them.
Well, I got approached by a man with I think it was an AK-47 in Panama. Of all places, who kind of stopped me when I was with my significant other, and started asking me for my papers, and I said, "Well, wait a minute, I don't have it on me. I'm sorry, I don't understand." And he just said, "I love The Shield." He was Panamanian, and he scared the hell out of me for sure. And then it happened with an immigration officer flying back into this country, where he started asking me all kinds of questions and questions about drugs and this and that, and said, "I think you're lying to me." I said, "Man, I'm not lying to you. You can look through my bags." He said, "We're going to look through your bags. That's not the only thing we're going to look through." And then I was like, "Please take me into a room. Do whatever you have to do." And he said, "I'm just kidding with you, man. Go through. When's the next episode coming on? When's the next season start?" So they would just mess with you. It was like we were in this fraternity of guys in blue. And while it worked when they came up to you, it didn't always work when I tried to get out of a parking ticket or a speeding ticket.
Did you try?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely, I tried.
How?
I ran a stop sign in a neighborhood, and this cop kind of came up, and he let me off the hook. So he set a bad example. He's like, "Hey, man, all right, just don't do this again. I know you're close to home. Don't do this again. When's the next season starting?" So then I felt that, oh, there's a silent fraternity of guys that I'm a part of, and I didn't know it, but now I know it. And so the next time I got pulled over, I waited for the cop to come up to the side of the car, and I just kind of looked really cocky and just kind of laid back in my seat and said, "Hey there, how are you?" He's like, "Can I see your driver's license and registration, please?" I said, do you really need to see that? Come on. I mean, I'm a guy in blue." And he said, "Let me see your driver's license and registration, please." He came back and wrote me a ticket and said, "When's the next season? Come on."
It's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's a dream come true in a lot of ways. I've enjoyed it.
Walton Goggins is in the FX series Justified, which is shown Tuesday nights. There's two episodes left in the season. Justified has been renewed for a second season. Goggins also co-starred in the FX series The Shield and co-stars in the movie Predators, which will open this summer. You can watch three clips from Justified on our website, freshair.npr.org. Tracy Thorne is best known as half of the British duo Everything But the Girl, with her husband Ben Watt. Everything But the Girl hasn't put out a new album since 1999, and Thorne has spent her time primarily raising her three children with Watt. But now she's released Love and Its Opposite, which is her third solo album. Here's rock critic Ken Tucker's review.
Late in the afternoon, October. lights be coming on soon.
Middle-aged pop has been a mainstay of music for a long time now. The Who's old yell of "Hope I die before I get old" has become an irritating cliche whenever it's removed from the context of its song. Still, songs that actually grapple well with maturity, both as subject matter and as craft, remain rare. That's the first most obvious reason Tracy Thorne's Love and Its Opposite is such an invigorating tonic.
Matthew was a wised up kid. He found out everything before the rest of us did. He said, I don't think that you have to be married. And I don't know why I felt so scared. I just knew I didn't want to wear the long white dress. Long white dress.
In that song, Long White Dress, the narrator recalls apprehensiveness about getting married. She looks back on herself as a romantic kid whose fears were about the unknowable. What it's like to commit to someone, how you work out the daily mechanics of a relationship once that long white dress has been put in mothballs. Flash to years later, when the married woman looks around her and sees a dreadful sight that hadn't crossed her mind when she was young. Divorce. And its own set of fears and impossible problems.
Who's next? Who's next? Always the ones that you least expect. They seem so strong. Turned out she wanted more all along. And each time I hear who's to part, I examine my heart. See how it stands.
The beauty of Tracy Thorne's alto is enhanced by whatever experience she brings in her mid-40s, a wife and mother, to continue the kind of romantic ballads she and her partner in everything, Ben Watt, have constructed here. Sometimes the arrangements are as simple as allowing Thorne to accompany herself with a few stark piano chords on the song I just played, Oh, the Divorces. Actually, it's less a song than a small novel, some cross between Faye Weldon and John Updike. Elsewhere, Thorne insists upon a lighter touch, as in this dialogue between a mother and her teenage offspring, passing each other biologically on hormones.
Yours are just kicking in, mine are just checking out. You're at the beginning of this tunnel, and I'm just coming out. Either way, these days when I'm as in control.
Music on Love and Its Opposite is a subtle shift in the sound Thorne and Watt developed earlier in their careers. The cool jazz and frequent Latin rhythms of the Everything But the Girl albums have been scaled back and localized. This is very much a British pop album soaked in American singer-songwriter emotions. There's a bit of Christine McVie in Thorne's voice and blue period Joni Mitchell in the keyboards. This musical strategy allows her freedom to tell meticulously detailed stories such as Singles Bar, whose main character slips off her wedding ring and wonders if you can tell her age by the size of her jeans as she orders a drink.
Is there room for one more at the Singles Bar? I've been working up the courage all year. I pull off my ring. I push my way in. hoping it ain't it here. Can you guess my age in this light? Who'll be taking me home tonight? So pour me.
Throughout Love and Its Opposite, Thorne sounds both comfy and unsettled. On her Facebook page, Thorne identifies herself as a, quote, singer, gardener, and bedsit disco queen. That kind of mocking wryness serves her well as she navigates the life she's been living and the challenge of making music as complex as that life.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Tracy Thorne's new album, Love and Its Opposite. You can listen to three songs from the album, including Oh, the Divorces, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Jane Smiley never shies away from new terrain in her work. Among other topics, she's written about racehorses and dentistry, Dickens and dairy farms. Her latest novel, called Private Life, scrutinizes marital disappointments against the backdrop of historical tragedies. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
The heroine of Jane Smiley's latest novel, Private Life, lives with her husband at the Naval Shipyard on Mare Island, north of San Francisco. There, while in bed one evening in 1906, she feels the earth move, and it has nothing to do with her husband. A lamp falls off the bedside table, just minor damage. But over on the mainland, all hell breaks loose as San Francisco collapses in the great earthquake and fire that follows. Margaret Mayfield Early is a quiet woman who keeps her own counsel, a watcher rather than an actor in history's great dramas. The years roll on and other events transpire. Sailors leave Mare Island for service in World Wars I and II. The Spanish flu epidemic and the Great Depression hit. Margaret lives at a remove through them all, until one day she quietly realizes that the man she spent most of her life married to is, at best, a fool. This time, the epicenter of the earthquake is in her brain. Private Life is a powerful turn-of-the-last-century American novel in both chronology and style. It spans the decades from Margaret's childhood in Missouri after the Civil War up to the early years of World War II. Smiley has tried her hand at historical novels before, as well as an academic farce and even a suspense tale. But at bottom, she's always been a master chronicler of the climate changes in relationships. I think especially of her great-great novella, The Age of Grief. Here, her compelling story about a long marriage has an Edith Wharton, Henry James feel of sinister delicacy about it. Margaret is afflicted by the same strain of paralysis that defines Newland Archer in Wharton's Age of Innocence. In the opening section of the novel, shrewd older women around Margaret conspire to orchestrate her marriage at the desperately ripe old age of 27 to Captain Andrew Jackson Jefferson Early, a Navy astronomer in his 30s and the most famous man that their little Midwestern town has ever produced. Describing their courtship, Smiley's deadpan, omniscient narrator says that Margaret felt pleasing dread at Captain Early's approach and that their wedding was quickly accomplished. By the time Margaret understands both the betrayal she's been subjected to and the true character of her husband, her feeble spirit of defiance has all but calcified. Margaret and Andrew move to Mare Island immediately after the wedding because he's put in charge of the observatory there. Andrew has made a tentative reputation for himself with his theories about double stars. Soon he's filling up their small house with dusty piles of scientific journals, churning out boulder-sized books with titles like The Universe Explained, and engaging in one-sided debates with his nemesis, Albert Einstein. Reflecting on one of his manuscripts, which of course she's been expected to type, Margaret thinks, What Andrew's theory was, precisely, she could not herself have said, though she partially understood the second half of the second volume, which was that if they could harness the power of the ether, they would be as gods. Having been left to think and think and think, Andrew had made up his mind that thinking was everything. Over the decades, Margaret, like a lot of women, carves out a small, separate life for herself without explicitly recognizing this as a marital survival strategy. She befriends a Russian emigre and a Nellie Bly-type female journalist and a Japanese-American family. Our narrator tells us that Margaret, at 60, had gotten into the habit of congratulating herself for being balanced. But, she saw, she was balanced on a very narrow perch. Private Life is a wistful and beautifully observed novel about nice girls finishing last. Margaret always listened to her practical mother, who opined that romance was always the first act of a tragedy. But as Smiley makes clear, relationships that don't have their roots in passion are capable of their own peculiar devastations of spirit.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Private Life by Jane Smiley. You can read a chapter on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.